Chapter 34. Ivanogorov's plan had been contrived with the greatest care, and except for some unforeseen accident he believed that it must succeed. It was of importance that the Bolshaya Gate should be unguarded, or only feebly held, when he gave it up. The attention of the besieged was therefore to be drawn to another part of the town. A diversion was agreed upon with the Emir. This diversion was to be effected both up and down the river, on the Irkutsk bank. The attack on these two points was to be conducted in earnest, and at the same time a feigned attempt at crossing the Angara from the left bank was to be made. The Bolshaya Gate would be probably deserted, so much the more, because on this side the Tartar outposts, having drawn back, would appear to have broken up. It was the 5th of October. In 24 hours, the capital of Eastern Siberia would be in the hands of the Emir, and the Grand Duke in the power of Ivanogorov. During the day, an unusual stir was going on in the Angara camp. From the windows of the palace, important preparations on the opposite shore could be distinctly seen. Numerous Tartar detachments were converging towards the camp, and from hour to hour, reinforced the Emir's troops. These movements, intended to deceive the besieged, were conducted in the most open manner possible before their eyes. Ogarov had warned the Grand Duke that an attack was to be feared. He knew, he said, that an assault was to be made, both above and below the town, and he counseled the Duke to reinforce the two directly threatened points. Accordingly, after a council of war had been held in the palace, orders were issued to concentrate the defense on the bank of the Angara, and at the two ends of the town, where the earthworks protected the river. This was exactly what Ogarov wished. He did not expect that the Bolshaya Gate would be left entirely without defenders, but that there would only be a small number. Besides, Ogarov meant to give such importance to the diversion that the Grand Duke would be obliged to oppose it with all his available forces. The traitor planned also to produce so frightful a catastrophe that terror must inevitably overwhelm the hearts of the besieged. All day the garrison and population of Irkutsk were on the alert. The measures to repel an attack on the points hitherto unassailed had been taken. The Grand Duke and General Voronzov visited the posts, strengthened by their orders. Wassily Feeder's corps occupied the north of the town, but with orders to throw themselves where the danger was greatest. The right bank of the Angara had been protected with the few guns possessed by the defenders. With these measures, taken in time, thanks to the advice so opportunely given by Ivanogorov, there was good reason to hope that the expected attack would be repulsed. In that case the Tartars, momentarily discouraged, would no doubt not make another attempt against the town for several days. Now the troops expected by the Grand Duke might arrive at any hour. The safety or the loss of Irkutsk hung only by a thread. On this day, the sun, which had risen at 6:20, set at 5:40, having traced its diurnal arc for 11 hours above the horizon. The twilight would struggle with the night for another 2 hours. Then it would be intensely dark, for the sky was cloudy, and there would be no moon. This gloom would favor the plans of Ivanogorov. For a few days already a sharp frost had given warning of the approaching rigor of the Siberian winter, and this evening it was especially severe. The Russians posted by the bank of the Angara, obliged to conceal their position, lighted no fires. They suffered cruelly from the low temperature. A few feet below them, the ice in large masses drifted down the current. All day these masses had been seen passing rapidly between the two banks. This had been considered by the Grand Duke and his officers as fortunate. Should the channel of the Angara continue to be thus obstructed, the passage must be impracticable. The Tartars could use neither rafts nor boats. As to their crossing the river on the ice, that was not possible. The newly frozen plain could not bear the weight of an assaulting column. This circumstance, as it appeared favorable to the defenders of Irkutsk, Ogarov might have regretted. He did not do so, however. The traitor knew well that the Tartars would not try to pass the Angara, and that, on its side at least, their attempt was only a feint. About 10 in the evening, the state of the river sensibly improved, to the great surprise of the besieged, and still more to their disadvantage. The passage till then impracticable became all at once possible. The bed of the Angara was clear. The blocks of ice, which had for some days drifted past in large numbers, disappeared down the current, and five or six only now occupied the space between the banks. The Russian officers reported this change in the river to the Grand Duke. They suggested that it was probably caused by the circumstance that in some narrower part of the Angara, the blocks had accumulated so as to form a barrier. We know this was the case. The passage of the Angara was thus open to the besiegers. There was great reason for the Russians to be on their guard. Up to midnight nothing had occurred. On the eastern side, beyond the Bolshaya Gate, all was quiet. Not a glimmer was seen in the dense forest, which appeared confounded on the horizon with the masses of clouds hanging low down in the sky. Lights flitting to and fro in the Angara camp showed that a considerable movement was taking place. From a verst above and below the point where the scarp met the river's bank came a dull murmur, proving that the Tartars were on foot, expecting some signal. An hour passed. Nothing new. The bell of the Irkutsk Cathedral was about to strike 2 o'clock in the morning, and not a movement amongst the besiegers had yet shown that they were about to commence the assault. The Grand Duke and his officers began to suspect that they had been mistaken. Had it really been the Tartars' plan to surprise the town? The preceding nights had not been nearly so quiet. Musketry rattling from the outposts, shells whistling through the air, and this time, nothing. The officers waited, ready to give their orders according to circumstances. We have said that Agarov occupied a room in the palace. It was a large chamber on the ground floor, its windows opening on a side terrace. By taking a few steps along this terrace, a view of the river could be obtained. Profound darkness reigned in the room. Agarov stood by a window, awaiting the hour to act. The signal, of course, could come from him, alone. This signal once given, when the greater part of the defenders of Irkutsk would be summoned to the points openly attacked, his plan was to leave the palace and hurry to the Bolshaya Gate. If it was unguarded, he would open it, or at least he would direct the overwhelming mass of its assailants against the few defenders. He now crouched in the shadow, like a wild beast ready to spring on its prey. A few minutes before 2 o'clock, the Grand Duke desired that Michael Strogoff, which was the only name they could give to Ivan Agarov, should be brought to him. An aide-de-camp came to the room, the door of which was closed. He called. Agarov, motionless near the window, and invisible in the shade, did not answer. The Grand Duke was therefore informed that the Tsar's courier was not at that moment in the palace. 2 o'clock struck. Now was the time to cause the diversion agreed upon with the Tartars, waiting for the assault. Ivan Agarov opened the window and stationed himself at the north angle of the side terrace. Below him flowed the roaring waters of the Angara. Agarov took a match from his pocket, struck it and lighted a small bunch of tow, impregnated with priming powder, which he threw into the river. It was by the orders of Ivan Agarov that the torrents of mineral oil had been thrown on the surface of the Angara. There are numerous naphtha springs above Irkutsk, on the right bank, between the suburb of Pashkovsk and the town. Agarov had resolved to employ this terrible means to carry fire into Irkutsk. He therefore took possession of the immense reservoirs which contained the combustible liquid. It was only necessary to demolish a piece of wall in order to allow it to flow out in a vast stream. This had been done that night, a few hours previously, and this was the reason that the raft which carried the true courier of the Tsar, Nadia, and the fugitives, floated on a current of mineral oil. Through the breaches in these reservoirs of enormous dimensions rushed the naphtha in torrents, and, following the inclination of the ground, it spread over the surface of the river, where its density allowed it to float. This was the way Ivan Ogarev carried on warfare. Allied with Tartars, he acted like a Tartar, and against his own countrymen. The tow had been thrown on the waters of the Angara. In an instant, with electrical rapidity, as if the current had been of alcohol, the whole river was in a blaze above and below the town. Columns of blue flames ran between the two banks. Volumes of vapor curled up above. The few pieces of ice which still drifted were seized by the burning liquid, and melted like wax on the top of a furnace, the evaporated water escaping in shrill hisses. At the same moment, firing broke out on the north and south of the town. The enemy's batteries discharged their guns at random. Several thousand Tartars rushed to the assault of the earthworks. The houses on the bank, built of wood, took fire in every direction. A bright light dissipated the darkness of the night. "At last," said Ivan Ogarev. He had good reason for congratulating himself. The diversion which he had planned was terrible. The defenders of Irkutsk found themselves between the attack of the Tartars and the fearful effects of fire. The bells rang, and all the able-bodied of the population ran, some towards the points attacked, and others towards the houses in the grasp of the flames, which it seemed too probable would ere long envelop the whole town. The gate of Bolchaya was nearly free. Only a very small guard had been left there. And by the traitor's suggestion, and in order that the event might be explained apart from him, as if by political hate, this small guard had been chosen from the little band of exiles. Ogarev re-entered his room, now brilliantly lighted by the flames from the Angara. Then he made ready to go out. But scarcely had he opened the door, when a woman rushed into the room, her clothes drenched, her hair in disorder. "Sanger!" exclaimed Ogarev, in the first moment of surprise, and not supposing that it could be any other woman than the gypsy. It was not Sanger, it was Nadia. At the moment when, floating on the ice, the girl had uttered a cry on seeing the fire spreading along the current, Michael had seized her in his arms, and plunged with her into the river itself to seek a refuge in its depths from the flames. The block which bore them was not 30 fathoms from the first quay of Irkutsk. Swimming beneath the water, Michael managed to get a footing with Nadia on the quay. Michael Strogoff had reached his journey's end. He was in Irkutsk. "To the governor's palace," said he to Nadia. In less than 10 minutes, they arrived at the entrance to the palace. Long tongues of flame from the Angara licked its walls, but were powerless to set it on fire. Beyond, the houses on the bank were in a blaze. The palace being open to all, Michael and Nadia entered without difficulty. In the confusion, no one remarked them, although their garments were dripping. A crowd of officers coming for orders, and of soldiers running to execute them, filled the great hall on the ground floor. There, in a sudden eddy of the confused multitude, Michael and the young girl were separated from each other. Nadia ran distracted through the passages, calling her companion, and asking to be taken to the Grand Duke. A door into a room flooded with light opened before her. She entered, and found herself suddenly face to face with the man whom she had met at Ichim, whom she had seen at Tomsk, face to face with the one whose villainous hand would an instant later betray the town. "Ivan Ogarev," she cried. On hearing his name pronounced, the wretch started. His real name known, all his plans would be balked. There was but one thing to be done. To kill the person who had just uttered it. Ogarev darted at Nadia, but the girl, a knife in her hand, retreated against the wall, determined to defend herself. "Ivan Ogarev!" again cried Nadia, knowing well that so detested a name would soon bring her help. "Ah! Be silent!" hissed out the traitor between his clenched teeth. "Ivan Ogarev!" exclaimed a third time the brave young girl, in a voice to which hate had added tenfold strength. Mad with fury, Ogarev, drawing a dagger from his belt, again rushed at Nadia, and compelled her to retreat into a corner of the room. Her last hope appeared gone, when the villain, suddenly lifted by an irresistible force, was dashed to the ground. "Michael!" cried Nadia. It was Michael Strogoff. Michael had heard Nadia's call. Guided by her voice, he had just in time reached Ivan Agarov's room, and entered by the open door. "Fear nothing, Nadia," said he, placing himself between her and Agarov. "Ah!" cried the girl, "take care, brother. The traitor is armed. He can see." Agarov rose, and, thinking he had an immeasurable advantage over the blind man, leaped upon him. But with one hand, the blind man grasped the arm of his enemy, seized his weapon, and hurled him again to the ground. Pale with rage and shame, Agarov remembered that he wore a sword. He drew it, and returned a second time to the charge. A blind man. Agarov had only to deal with a blind man. He was more than a match for him. Nadia, terrified at the danger which threatened her companion, ran to the door calling for help. "Close the door, Nadia," said Michael. "I'll no one, and leave me alone. The Tsar's courier has nothing to fear today from this villain. Let him come on, if he dares. I am ready for him." In the meantime, Agarov, gathering himself together like a tiger about to spring, uttered not a word. The noise of his footsteps, his very breathing, he endeavored to conceal from the ear of the blind man. His object was to strike before his opponent was aware of his approach, to strike him with a deadly blow. Nadia, terrified and at the same time confident, watched this terrible scene with involuntary admiration. Michael's calm bearing seemed to have inspired her. Michael's sole weapon was his Siberian knife. He did not see his adversary armed with a sword, it is true, but heaven's support seemed to be afforded him. How, almost without stirring, did he always face the point of the sword? Ivan Agarov watched his strange adversary with visible anxiety. His superhuman calm had an effect upon him. In vain, appealing to his reason, did he tell himself that in so unequal a combat all the advantages were on his side. The immobility of the blind man froze him. He had settled on the place where he would strike his victim. He had fixed upon it. What, then, hindered him from putting an end to his blind antagonist? At last, with a spring he drove his sword full at Michael's breast. An imperceptible movement of the blind man's knife turned aside the blow. Michael had not been touched, and coolly he awaited a second attack. Cold drops stood on Agarov's brow. He drew back a step, then again leaped forward. But as at the first, the second attempt failed. The knife had simply parried the blow from the traitor's useless sword. Mad with rage and terror before this living statue, he gazed into the wide open eyes of the blind man. Those eyes which seemed to pierce to the bottom of his soul, and yet which did not, could not, see, exercised a sort of dreadful fascination over him. All at once, Agarov uttered a cry. A sudden light flashed across his brain. "He sees!" he exclaimed, "he sees!" And like a wild beast trying to retreat into its den, step by step, terrified, he drew back to the end of the room. Then the statue became animated. The blind man walked straight up to Ivan Agarov, and placing himself right before him, "Yes, I see," said he. "See the mark of the knout which I gave you, traitor and coward. I see the place where I am about to strike you. Defend your life. It is a duel I deign to offer you. My knife against your sword." "He sees," said Nadia. "Gracious heaven, is it possible?" Agarov felt that he was lost. But mustering all his courage, he sprang forward on his impassable adversary. The two blades crossed, but at a touch from Michael's knife, wielded in the hand of the Siberian hunter, the sword flew in splinters, and the wretch, stabbed to the heart, fell lifeless on the ground. At the same moment, the door was thrown open. The Grand Duke, accompanied by some of his officers, appeared on the threshold. The Grand Duke advanced. In the body lying on the ground, he recognized the man whom he believed to be the Tsar's courier. Then, in a threatening voice, "Who killed that man?" he asked. "I," replied Michael. "One of the officers put a pistol to his temple, ready to fire." "Your name?" asked the Grand Duke, before giving the order for his brains to be blown out. Your Highness, answered Michael, ask me rather the name of the man who lies at your feet. That man, I know him. He is a servant of my brother. He is the Tsar's courier. That man, Your Highness, is not a courier of the Tsar. He is Ivan Ogaroff. Ivan Ogaroff! Exclaimed the Grand Duke. Yes, Ivan the traitor. But who are you then? Michael Strogoff. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.